This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, let's get this road show back on the road. The number is 888-914-9149. Everyone is welcome here, regardless of your perspective. I'd love to hear from you. 888-914-9149. We'll go to Robert in La Crosse, Wisconsin first. Hi, Robert. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
I was listening to NPR like I do all day, every day. I'm a working man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a Republican business owner. I like to go green in the green business. And listening to NPR all the time and the critical race theory, I've had about enough, but, you know, a panic attack situation.
Okay.
So I got to change the radio station. And here you are, sir. Praise God.
Thank you.
And then it,
a little different kind of conversation on this program from what you probably were hearing on NPR, I would guess, right?
Not too much.
Okay.
The only difference is there's a little less baloney I'm hearing.
Hopefully a lot less baloney on this program, but I'm glad you made the switch. I hope I can work as hard as possible to make that a permanent switch and have you listen
all
to Relevant Radio all day.
All week long, I'm hearing how I am racist for this, that, and the other, and no, sir, I'm not.
That's
and
right.
How I heard how the tax system is my place, correct?
I missed that.
And
the tax system is what?
Monetary based, how much you make.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this professional woman claimed that the tax system is racist because it is just that. It's not race-based at all. It's monetary-based.
So the tax system is not my area of specialité, let's just say. So that aside, now that you're listening to Relevant Radio, are you ready to go all in, whole hog, Relevant Radio 24/7?
I've been. Yes, sir.
Awesome. Because NPR is just going to rot your brain, and you've already experienced that.
I'm in a panic attack situation because I can't be called this again. It's just when she said that is racist because it doesn't cater to them. There's no box to check on what you are, whatever word they choose, whatever word of the week they are.
Mm-hmm.
The woke joke, whatever these words are, the word of the week.
Right.
There's no tax IRS box to check for them. So it's.
I hear you. Well, Robert, I can tell you this much. You're always welcome here at Relevant Radio. You're welcome here at the table on my program as well as all the other ones. We don't serve bologna here. I'm sorry. Other people do. If you need bologna, you can go down to NPR. I think they have a bologna buffet. But in any case, no, we try to serve the real thing here. And I'm really glad to know that by tuning in, you've kind of caught on to that. And I really hope you'll continue listening. All I ask personally is just 3 hours of your day. That's all. That's all I'm looking for. Sound like
a fair bargain? Let's pray. Pray.
All right, Robert. Thank you. Yeah, prayers, very much so. Thank you. Let's go to George now in Anaheim, California. Hi, George.
Hi, Patrick. My question is about critical race theory as well. So when I hear you talk about it on Relevant Radio, I understand that the big evil here is that they demonize white people and white people are inherently racist. When I do my own little research online on YouTube, I look up, you know, what is critical race theory? I'd like to hear from the proponents of it. They all rebut that general idea. You know, that you state on the radio that, oh, it demonizes white people. They say, no, critical race theory only teaches the structures of racism in in society, we do not teach that, you know, white people are demons or are evil. We do not try to divide. We just want to teach the structural structures of race. So I'm trying to...
Is that so? And George, do you actually believe that?
Well, I'm trying to get to the bottom of it. So I don't, you know, I just hear them rebut that general idea that I hear on Relevant Radio and other, you know, public commentators. So I just want to try to see, you know, where does the truth lie?
Yeah, right.
Where does the truth lie? Correct.
Right. Okay, so let me help you out, George. You came to the right place. I'm going to share with you right now some quotes from some of the leading exponents of critical race theory. So we're talking about people like Robin DiAngelo, who has a bestseller called White Fragility. It's all the rage right now. She has a follow-up book to that. So stick with me, George. I'm going to share with you verbatim from these people, and you can, in fact, I'm going to send you to the document where everything is footnoted, and you can check it for yourself if you, you know, if for whatever reason you don't want to take my word for it. So here goes. Robin DiAngelo, White Fragility. Whiteness is dynamic, relational, and operating at all times and on myriad levels. These processes and practices include basic rights, values, beliefs, perspectives, and experiences purported to be commonly shared by all, but which are actually only consistently afforded to white people. Darrell Sue, S-U-E, from The Invisible Whiteness of Being. Whiteness is an invisible veil that cloaks its racist, deleterious effects through individuals, organizations, and society. Now, you notice that he doesn't say racism is an invisible veil. He says whiteness is an invisible veil. So it's singling out people by their skin color. The result, he says, is that white people are allowed to enjoy the benefits that accrue to them by virtue of their skin color. Thus, whiteness, white supremacy, and white privilege are three interlocking forces that disguise racism so it may allow white people to oppress and harm persons of color while maintaining their individual and collective advantage and innocence. Again, that's from Darrell Sue, The Invisible Whiteness of Being. This is from Johnny Williams, and he wrote this in the Hartford Current newspaper. Whiteness, by its very definition and operation as a key element of white supremacy, kills. It is mental and physical terrorism. To end the white terrorism that is directed at racially oppressed people here and in other nations, it is essential that self-identified whites and their whiteness collaborators among the racially oppressed confront their white problem head-on, unencumbered by racial comfort. This from Barbara Applebaum in Being White, Being Good. She says, all white people are racist or complicit by virtue of benefiting from privileges that are not something they can voluntarily renounce. Again, Robin DiAngelo from White Fragility. White identity is inherently racist. White people do not exist outside of the system of white supremacy. Here's Ibram Kendi, who's a major figure in critical race theory. He says, according to studies, babies at 2 to 3 years old start internalizing racist ideas, start discerning and making decisions based on racist ideas. We're allowing our society to raise them to be racist. Here is again from Robin DiAngelo from White Fragility. White people raised in Western society are conditioned into a white supremacist worldview because it is the bedrock of our society and its institutions. Entering the conversation with this understanding is freeing because it allows us to focus on how rather than if our racism is manifest. Andrew Hacker from Two Nations says, America is inherently a white country in character, in structure, in culture. Needless to say, black Americans create lives of their own. Yet as a people, they face boundaries and constrictions set by the white majority, America's version of apartheid. While lacking overt legal sanction, comes closest to the system even now being reformed in the land of its invention. Ibram Kendi, again, in How to Be an Anti-Racist, says, it's a racial crime to be yourself if you are not white in America. It is a racial crime to look like yourself or empower yourself if you are not white. These things are ridiculous on the face of them, but I want, for further effect, to quote a few more for them. Here's Delgado and Stefanik in Critical Race Theory, an Introduction. This is a book. Many critical race theorists and social scientists alike hold that racism is pervasive, systemic, and deeply ingrained. If we take this perspective, then no white member of society seems quite so innocent. Wildman and Davis, Readings for Diversity and Social Justice, say, all whites are racist because we benefit from systemic white privilege. Generally, whites think of racism as voluntary, intentional conduct done by horrible others. Whites spend a lot of time trying to convince ourselves and each other that we're not racist. A big step would be for whites to admit that we are racist and then to consider what to do about it. Delgado and Stefanik again from Critical Race Theory, an introduction. Unlike traditional civil rights, which embraces incrementalism and step-by-step progress, critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and neutral principles of constitutional law. So you can see there that they're calling everything into question. Again, from the same book, critical race theorists are also highly suspicious of other liberal mainstay, of another liberal mainstay, namely rights. Think how that system applauds affording everyone equality of opportunity, but resists programs that assure equality of results. Let's pause there for a second. This is saying if you merit some benefit like a scholarship or being accepted to a university or a job or some other such thing, if you merit that because you are good at that or you have demonstrated prowess or some achievement and therefore you earn the right to these emoluments, that's wrong, they're saying. That's racist because the only way to make this right would be everybody gets the same results. They want to assure the equality of results, which in that case would eliminate merit. It would eliminate skill. It would eliminate trying hard. None of that would really matter because everybody has to have the same exact results, according to them. And there's so much more. I've only given you a dozen or so comments from this, and you can find all of this and much more in a document by Christopher Rufo. It's called Critical Race Theory Briefing Book. And the majority of this document is simply quote after quote after quote, meticulously footnoted and documented from the very people who are promoting this theory at the leading edge. So my suggestion, George, would be check this out. You know, if you feel as though what you're hearing me say is a distortion of critical race theory, notwithstanding whatever you may have read on Wikipedia, check out these sources. These are the people, Robin DiAngelo and others. These are the people who are, they're marketing this theory. They're packaging it and marketing it, and other people are factory repping it in our schools, etc. If you don't believe me, believe them. Because they're the ones who are saying these things. And what I'm here to do is to push back against the aspects of this that are wrong. Anyway, I'll leave it at that, George. I hope that's helpful to you, and I do appreciate the phone call. Let's go now to Jose in we're going to get to Jose. Let's get to David in McLean, Virginia. Hi, David. Welcome.
Hello, Patrick. Delighted to make it. I hope I can change the subject from critical race
Please
theory.
Please do. I'm happy to
theology.
Change the subject.
Yes.
Happy to change.
Oh, yeah. So I would like to discuss, if possible, a call you had with a young man. I think his name was Ridley, and he was confronting something that I think a lot of Christians do. Namely the question of how can a good and loving God abandon how many souls to eternal torment, eternally and forever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad you mentioned the prodigal son a few minutes ago, because imagine, if you will, the prodigal son returning, and you know, it says his father saw him from afar off. Imagine instead of running to him and putting a ring on his finger and shoes on his feet, he, you know, stood at the porch with his arms crossed and tapping his toes, and he said, "Father, let me just be one of your hired hands." And Dad were to say, "Sorry, too late. You're, you know, get out of here. You've gotten your inheritance. Go away."
Yeah,
I'm sure you and I and most people would agree that that would be a dreadful characterization of God's mercy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let me. So I say that to set up the idea that, and while I didn't disagree with anything you said, I think a lot of people get the impression that there are lots of souls in hell calling out to God for mercy and begging for forgiveness, and he's not listening to them. And I don't think that's the case.
I don't either. I wouldn't agree with that thesis. I'm glad to hear that you don't either.
Well, but I think a lot of people get that impression because, you know, well, you know, you die in a state of mortal sin and you're going to hell, right? I'm in awe of the way that you managed to quote the most appropriate book for the question you seem to be getting. But I have never heard you quote or cite anything by C.S. Lewis.
And oh,
I
gosh,
know he's not a Catholic.
No, I have great regard for C.S. Lewis. I'm a student of his.
Oh,
and,
good. I'm
very high
delighted
regard for
to
him.
Hear it.
Yeah. In fact, well, it's interesting you mentioned him because we actually talked about one of his books, The Great Divorce, on this program within the last several days. Yeah. So when it's pertinent, I do bring up C.S. Lewis, or at least I'm more than happy to talk about his contributions. Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that because I wanted, when you were talking to Ridley, I wanted to hear you say, go read The Great Divorce.
Yeah, I want as much as the next guy for hell to not be true. I wish that hell were not true. I wish that Jesus didn't talk about hell as much as he did, but he did. And so it's not me who wants to say, if you die in the state of mortal sin, you go to hell. I mean, I would rather not have it that way. But Jesus himself, over and over again, he warns about hell. He warns about eternal fire. Matthew chapter 25, he talks about it with the sheep and the goats, as you know, and he says, then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. It's just so, the Gospels are replete with so many examples of Jesus warning about hell and being thrown into the fiery furnace. Matthew chapter 13, they'll be thrown into the fiery furnace in that place where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And of course, it's not just Jesus who speaks about this repeatedly. It's also a theme that is brought up by all the other apostolic writers of the New Testament. So trust me on this one. And believe me anyway, David, I'm with you. I wish it weren't that way, but I have no way to avoid. This is the forceful, continuous teaching of Jesus. And who am I to argue against what he said? You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, I do. And yet, in other words, the trouble, I think, is that those metaphors about sheep and goats and so on encourage this view of hell being full of people, you know, going, oh, no, please, I want to be with the sheep. I made a terrible mistake. Please forgive me.
Mm-hmm.
And as the Great Divorce, the metaphors of the Great Divorce talk about, how
a second
chance. It's these insubstantial people, have trouble walking across the blades of grass until they
right.
get harder, more
right.
real, more substantial, and that some of them, in fact, most of them, except the one man who is presumably guilty of sexual sins, all of them, one of the good people that comes down from the great mountain says to one of these people, if you could just for a minute think about someone other than yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very familiar with the book. I've read it and reread it many times, and I agree with you. It's a beautiful way of looking at this. Unfortunately, the C.S. Lewis approach to the getting a second chance and the people from hell coming up in the bus and then realizing there's so much more and better. And in the case of the man who had the little red lizard of lust on his shoulder, he's transformed because he's willing to do so. I'm totally on board with that. I wish it were true, but that's not what the gospel presents to us. That's not what Jesus and St. Paul and St. Peter and St. John say to us. Their teaching, beginning with Jesus, is that once you pass from this life into the next life, your decision is permanent. It's irrevocable. And I would much rather that Jesus had taught the C.S. Lewis version of things, but he didn't. So I'm going to have to go with Jesus on this one.
So that's interesting because I'm not in great disagreement with the other metaphor you cited about hardening concrete, mm-hmm. but that's a gradual process, and I agree that it eventually becomes hard. I'll tell you one last thought to wrap this up. I think that life is a process of preparing for the awesome judgment seat of God, and that awesome judgment seat of God is going to be terrifying, and that people who spend their life trying to know and to love God and to do his will, when they see that terrifying fire, will run toward it and say, purify me, you know, extirpate every last vestige of sin from my consciousness. And people
right.
who have not been preparing for that moment will run away from it in fear. And
by then it'll be too late. Yeah, by then it will be too late, I'm afraid. Yes, up to a point. And those who are run toward it will be the souls in purgatory, who know that by being purified, they will enter into eternal glory after that. Well, let's make sure, David, you and I and everyone listening, let's make sure that we never have to worry about that eternal fire. Let's stick close to Jesus and go on the up elevator. I look forward to seeing you there, David. Thanks for the call. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Cyrus, am I looking at this right? Somebody put my face on a bunch of gunslinger scenes from
Isn't that amazing? Western movies. Yeah, if you want to see this, go to
relevantradio.com/Patrick.
It's on the Twitter feed.
Oh, you posted it already.
I did, yeah. It's phenomenal.
I'm looking at this, and I'm saying, that guy looks kind of familiar.
It's like, shouldn't that be Clint Eastwood? But it's got my face on it.
Right? When I get down to the very last one, and he's looking straight at the camera, then that's when I realize that he put my face on this.
Yeah, it's gold. So deep fake. That's a good deep fake.
Talk about a deep fake. Yep. Yeah.
So check that out. It's awesome.
All right, Lunger. Let's do it.
Yeah, he's going to have to do Tombstone next.
Oh, my God.
I think that was Good, Bad, the Ugly, or it's one of those old Clint Eastwood movies.
Well, my thanks to whoever did that. Now, was that on the basis of listening to the program today? Because maybe he thought that I had a quote-unquote shootout?
So let me – I'm trying to go there as fast as I can. He posted on Facebook, and we don't use Facebook as much as we use Twitter here on this particular show. And that's just the way – the cookie crumbles here.
Who do we
here.
Thank for this? Who's the kind citizen
I'm trying
who did
to look.
That?
Where'd it go? Sorry. I had
That's
it.
Okay.
Frank, his name's Frank Fortina. I'm so sorry for butchering your name. But Frank or Franck, it's F-R-A-N-C.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well,
it's
thank
awesome.
You. That's funny. I got a chuckle out of it during the break when I saw that.
Yeah, keep them coming.
Yeah, and of course I abhor violence, so this is purely metaphorical.
yes.
Yeah, okay.
That should be obvious.
I hope so. Let's go to Lisa listening in Los Angeles. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Patrick. First of all, I want to thank you for talking about CRT because I think it's very important, and a lot of people are not really understanding what is that about, and I would like also some information. I'm a teacher. And this is coming, but I'm not going along with that, CRT. So you mentioned an article, a PDF, about Christopher Ruffo.
Yes.
And I would like you to please tell me again. I mean, I know I cannot go to YouTube or anything like that because that's they're not going to tell me anything about that. I don't have Twitter.
Right.
They already started in our school. I'm in the second largest school district, and they already started giving in service and telling us about all that. And I'm a little worried about, the starting of the year. So I would like some advice on what to do.
And, okay, so I'll give you some advice. So it's very easy. You don't have to be on Twitter. Go to twitter.com/PatrickMadrid. You have to put that last part on there. That will take you to my Twitter feed. And in about 5 or 10 minutes, I'm going to be able to bump that up to the top of my Twitter feed. And this is the PDF that you're referring to. It's called Critical Race Theory Briefing Book by Christopher Ruffo. I think I may have misspoke his name. I think I might have said Matthew Ruffo, but it's Christopher Ruffo. And he wrote this for Hillsdale College, and I'm sure it's available there on their website. But this gives you a vast number of quotes directly taken from critical race theory proponents. So it's all well footnoted, well documented. And then the balance of it also gives you examples of critical race theory in corporations, critical race theory in government, critical race theory in academia. And it doesn't merely talk about it. It gives examples of it. with links to the articles and the position statements and the white papers and things like that. Oops, that's probably racist to say that. So that's all available there, and I would encourage you to start with this because you'll have everything at your fingertips and many resources that you can branch out from after reading that. So if you give me, so give me to this next break, I'll be able to pop it up there for you. So go to twitter.com/PatrickMadrid and you'll find it there. Okay, I hope that helps. And call me back in a month or two and let me know how it helps. I'd like to hear about it. Let's go to Jose in Richmond, California. Hi, Jose.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning. I have
good
a
morning.
Question regarding morning. Yeah, I believe that everybody is born into the world to fulfill a mission. I would like to have your perspective on a baby who dies at a very young age, either a newborn or who really dies. What type of mission does that baby fulfill?
Well, the mission would not be like yours or mine because the child didn't live to be able to do anything. If nothing else, the child glorifies God by his existence. So it can be something as simple as that, for the glory of God. And also as a way to not only demonstrate God's glory by bringing people into existence, but also showing forth God's mercy and his justice. So it can be something as simple as that.
So why would that baby be different than an adult who dies at a very old age? Of course, the baby's soul would be already saved because he or she may not have committed any sins. But how would that be compared with a person who dies at a very old age who committed lots of sins?
I think the obvious point that comes to mind would be that in the case of somebody who lives a long life and then dies, that person had an opportunity, a lengthy opportunity, to love, know, and serve God in this life so that he could be happy with God in the life to come and to be forgiven of his sins, fall into sin, get back up again. That, too, is a mission of glorifying God and manifesting God's mercy and his justice. So let's assume that the person who dies at the end of a long life goes to heaven. Well, that's part of it, but also all the ways in which he would have influenced other people, maybe brought children into the world and grandchildren, influenced the lives of other people for better or for worse. So there's a great deal that can be said about that, but I'm not sure what the question is related to that person who dies in old age compared to the baby. Maybe you can sharpen that for me. What is the question there?
Sure. What I'm trying to understand is, of course, a baby who a soul that dies at a very young age because a baby would have all the chance to go to heaven than a person who dies at a very old age that have committed lots of sins.
Okay. Well, we know from Scripture, it says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, that God wills that all men be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. So we know that God does not desire the death or the damnation of anybody. And since he desires that all be saved, there must be some way that all can be saved. It doesn't mean that all will be saved, but it means that all have an opportunity to be saved. So that being the case, we see that under normal circumstances, that opportunity for salvation comes from hearing about Jesus Christ, believing in him, having faith in Jesus, repenting from one's sins, and being baptized, and then doing the things that Jesus says to do. So that would be the normative process. Now, those outside the norm, who through no fault of their own never had that opportunity, say a baby who is born in a miscarriage or who dies in infancy without the benefit of baptism, to use that example. God wills also the salvation of those children, but because of no fault of their own, they were not able to proceed toward salvation through the norm, which all the rest of us must do. So then it opens the question, well, then how can that person be saved? So one theory that was predominant for quite a long time was the theory of limbo, which held unlike the rigorists who believed that the souls of unbaptized babies would go to hell, or a very light punishment area of hell, and maybe even an area of hell that wasn't really punishment at all, but they were still in hell. Some held that view. St. Augustine, he proposed that view against the Pelagian heresy, which taught that you could get to heaven even just on your own merits. And as a way of opposing that, St. Augustine held the view that even those infants who died without the benefit of baptism, not because they had sinned, but because they didn't have sanctifying grace, that they would end up in that sort of, you might say, like a fringe area of hell. And the church does not hold that view, even though some theologians like St. Augustine once did. The view that became predominant was that of limbo, which would be for a child who died without the benefit of baptism. They would go to a place of perfect natural happiness that was not hell, but it also wasn't heaven, because in order to live in heaven, you have to have sanctifying grace. And without baptism, you don't have sanctifying grace. So the thought was that this satisfied both God's mercy and his justice, and that the children and others who would go to limbo were perfectly happy in a natural sense, though not supernatural. But in recent centuries, the church, and certainly in recent decades, the church has moved much more firmly in the direction of saying that, in a way known only to God, that he will provide sanctifying grace for the souls of those who die without the benefit of baptism, talking here about infants as an example, and that it has not been revealed to us. But Pope Benedict XVI and others have emphasized that we should take the posture of hope and trust in God's mercy and his desire to see these children saved. So those are some thoughts. I hope that's helpful, Jose. I appreciate the interesting question. These are important questions because so many people are dealing with the loss of a child. Let's go to Paul now, listening in Pensacola, Florida. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Patrick. I hate to bring up critical race theory again.
Oh, it's okay. It's all right.
But I think one question that never gets asked, and I think it would help puncture this balloon, is genocide through Planned Parenthood and abortion, is that some kind of privilege? Is that some kind of atrocity that needs to be addressed?
You know who has been bringing that up quite a bit is the man behind Black Genocide, I think it's blackgenocide.org. And he himself is a black man. I'm going to get his information up here. In fact, it's sort of blocked by a lot of these organizations. Like if you put it into Google, they won't even bring it up. They won't even show it to you. But there's an example of a man who is making it very much in the forefront of showing how disproportionately black babies are killed in abortion. Far more, just, you know, in terms of percentages, far more than white or other ethnic groups. So I would refer you to that website, blackgenocide.org. Lots of information there. And it gets to the heart of your question. How come that issue is not brought up? Well, oil and water don't mix. And critical race theory and being pro-life don't mix. As you'll notice that it's the radical screamers on the left, you know, the lunatic left, if you want to, there's, I suppose, a lunatic right, but there's also a lunatic left. And the people who are purveying these theories generally, almost always, have no good things to say about the pro-life movement. So for them, it's a topic to be ignored.
And that makes me question their motives.
As well it should. As well it should, because if they were consistent, there would be outrage and effort to stop the genocide of black people through abortion. But they don't care about that. They don't really care about it. All they can care about is controlling people. That's the end game for them. And so the abortion issue is just a speed bump, or worse, because it slows down their effort to control people. And who cares about them anyway? You know, there's a lot of money to be made in big abortion. And you scratch my back, I scratch yours. That's how it is with politicians and others and big abortion in this country. And everyone knows it. And there's a lot of money to be made and to be passed around. So they don't want to get in the way of that. Therefore, they ignore it. It's a non-issue.
And it's also a great way to destroy the family.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look at Black Lives Matter. It was taken down from their website when people started to catch on to it. But long about June of last year, I remember reading verbatim from the Black Lives Matter About Us section on their website. And it was all this stuff about we plan to disrupt the nuclear family, and we want to queer everything, and we want to this, and we want to that. And once people like started to hear this and say, whoa, what? Then they took it down. And now there's just this plain vanilla. I hope that's not racist, but there's just this plain vanilla information about them. So all the stuff about the Marxism and disrupting the nuclear family and queering of things, and that's all gone now. Because they don't really want people to see that. If they, you know, to get the greatest number of people on board with them, they realize that there are a lot of people who are going to see that and say, I don't want to be part of that. So they removed it. And you won't see it on their website now, et cetera, et cetera. You get the idea, right, Paul?
Yeah, so I think all this talk about finding their voices, I don't think it's their voices that are being heard. I think the puppet master's voices are what's coming through.
Maybe, but this is just a retread, Paul. This is a retread of Marxist political theory. I remember when I did my undergraduate degree in philosophy, we had to study Marxist political theory as part of it. And it's this is that. And the only things that have changed is the categories of the oppressor and the oppressed are now white people and black people and other people, quote unquote, people of color, whatever that means. And previously, under the Marxist style of this, I mean, it's still Marxism. It's just under a different guise. It was the proletariat that was being oppressed, and you had the bourgeoisie and the elite wealthy people who are the oppressors. And all they've done is change the labels. But it has the same net effect in keeping people controlled and angry and at each other's throats. And that's what whoever these puppet masters are, and I don't know who they are, all I know is that this theory is gaining ground, but it's really nothing new. It's just a retread of classic Marxism. That's all. And it's having the same general effect.
Well, I think it all goes back to the ultimate puppet master, which is the evil one.
Yeah, well, you know, he's laughing up a storm because the last thing he wants is for people to calm down and start looking at each other as fellow human beings and love loving one another as Jesus said we're supposed to do. That part of the gospel is anathema to the people who are pushing critical race theory. Absolutely. Anyway, we could go on and on, Paul, but I think you and I are on the same page, right?
Right. I just wanted to bring that up for the people defending critical race theory. It's not about bringing people together. It's not about raising people up. It's about pushing people down and keeping them down.
Yeah, that's right. And you heard it here first. We've talked about that quite a bit, but thank you, Paul. I appreciate it. I've got to take a break. Coming right back to you right after this. Please stay right there. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Allow me to draw your attention once again to a phenomenon that's taking place in the background. If you're not paying attention here, I want you to know about it. And that is that we're running out of things. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal. You need to read this. Supermarkets are stockpiling inventory as food costs rise. You may say that could never happen here. It's happening. I don't have time to go into the whole article with you, but I do encourage you to read this. It is startling what's happening right before our noses, before our eyes, under our noses. We're running out of stuff. And the supermarkets, the big supermarket chains, are realizing this. So they are, as the Wall Street Journal puts it, they're stockpiling food. Why are they stockpiling food? Because they know it will be more and more difficult to get it, not to mention the price of food going up and many other things going up as well. I told you about pool liners and chlorine for your pool. You can't get it. If you can get chlorine, buy as much as you can and share it with your neighbors, because people can't get chlorine. And you may say, why is that happening? And I don't claim to know all the reasons, but the Wall Street Journal is pretty good at putting two and two together. And in this article, they're doing that. But they're speaking specifically here about food, which obviously you have to have. So I'm not trying to be an alarmist. The last thing I want to do is scare you. I'm not interested in whipping up fear. Far from it. But at the same time, forewarned is forearmed, right? So a little bit of preparedness, in, just in case. Remember what it was like trying to get toilet paper a year ago? Okay? I rest my case. That's all. That's all I'm saying. Be aware of this, because it is happening. And we have an article for you here from the Wall Street Journal, which you can get by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick.
Cyrus, I told you so.
For you.
I told you so.
Yeah. I don't want to have to say that later. Anyway, so let's not say that later. Just forearmed, forewarned is forearmed. Let's go to Leo in Minneapolis. Hi, Leo.
Hi, Patrick. Kind of a follow-up to the discussion regarding God's mercy and how could a merciful God send people to hell.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I'm probably influenced by C.S. Lewis here a bit too, but I think people need to consider God's gift of free will in this. And what I mean by that is, I think of it, what helped me to clarify it in my mind is, I look at life as a practice that we spend our lives making choices to follow God's way, and or we make choices to not follow God's way. All our life we're doing this. Then we have that final moment of making the final choice. If we've been practicing all our lives not to follow God's way, it's going to be pretty hard to, at that final moment, make a choice to follow God and go with him into heaven. Mm-hmm. We're more likely to make a choice to go our way, away from God, and there you are on your way to hell, or right. In hell.
I like this way of putting it. I don't know who wrote this, but whoever wrote it, I really endorse it. Sow a thought, reap an action. Sow an action, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. Which is another way of saying what you're saying, that if your choices are always for God, for God, for God, for God, you're going to end up with God. But if the choices are against God, against God, against God, against God, when you get down to it, your final choice will be against God.
Yeah, so. And I wanted to avoid using the word habit, because habit does kind of get you a little bit away from free will, but essentially that's where I'm going with it too.
Yeah. Yeah, the life of, it's interesting you mentioned habit, because habitus is a term that's associated with virtue in St. Thomas Aquinas' theory of virtue, which is that it's like anything else, when you become accustomed to a certain thing and it becomes a stable condition or a stable characteristic of who you are, you just naturally, effortlessly do it. So somebody who practices playing the piano every day, maybe they don't know how to play the piano. One day they start learning how to play it, and it's difficult and it doesn't sound good, but they keep practicing and practicing. Eventually they can play the piano effortlessly. It just comes to them because it's a stable disposition that's in them. It's a talent in this case. And the virtues are exactly like that. They're habits that are built over time. And so you'll notice, I'm sure you've seen this, Leo, people who are well advanced in Christian maturity, they're well advanced in virtue, they don't slip up and make stupid mistakes and fall into serious sin, because the habit is that memory muscle or muscle memory of their virtuous living. And so they effortlessly, it seems, can just be virtuous. And the same is true on the other side, that vice has its own muscle memory. And the more it's reinforced, the more habits are reinforced, for example, in the case of vice, the more difficult it is to pull out of that, and the more effortless it is for someone to just be a liar. They just lie effortlessly because that's what they do, and it's been reinforced over time. So it's the breaking of the bad habits and the reinforcing of the good habits that leads to the point that you're making. And I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to speak a little bit about that. Thank you, Leo. Let's go now to where we're going. Ben in San Diego. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Patrick. Yeah, I wanted to just discuss briefly the article you were talking about. You know, I think a major problem is that, you know, they're talking about the shortages. I think it's just kind of a symptom in American society when we no longer have connection to our food systems. I mean, I'm sure many children have never even seen an animal or a farm. I mean, you know, here in Southern California, obviously, we have no virtual natural landscapes left, depending on where you live in Southern California. And I think that's kind of something that the church can focus on, because I've heard of some church parishes having, like, permaculture classes or even gardens to, you know, help feed people. Mm-hmm. I think it's just, you know, it's kind of a dual moral and crisis, as well as a security issue, because, you know, most of our food travels thousands of miles, and that's horrifyingly dangerous, especially as fuel prices rise.
You know, what's interesting, Ben, you're talking about, and by the way, I grew up in Southern California, born and raised there, and I have vivid memories as a child of seeing, for example, Irvine was wall-to-wall orange groves for a time, and I remember what it looked like, and I remember Ladera Ranch and Mission Viejo and much of Irvine, at least on the mountainous side, is just being empty hills. And as far as you could see in many directions, it was just emptiness. And now, of course, it's all built up. So I have a living memory of being there and seeing that. And, of course, as you say, it's completely the opposite now. But cast your mind back, Ben, and this is an important point you're bringing up here. I'd like to bring a parallel alongside. Cast your mind back to March, April of last year, when from practically 1 week to the next, all the churches closed. Remember that, when all the churches just shut down?
I do.
And you couldn't go to Mass, and you couldn't get your baby baptized, and you couldn't go to confession. You couldn't go inside a church because they were locked. Now, imagine if that were to happen with your grocery store. Imagine if suddenly...
Yeah, it's a terrifying idea. And I think we have a system where we're too reliant on these large, you know, chains to take care of us. And I know, you know, most people can't have, you know, a 5-acre farm or something with livestock, but...
Yeah, few people can do that. Now, virtually nobody can do that outside of rural areas. So the reason I bring this up is because we already experienced what that was like and the shock of it when our churches shut down. I think there's something here with regard to he hung up. Maybe whatever. I don't know why he hung up, but that's okay. I think there's something here to at least ponder, and that is, what you going to do if your local Ralph's or Food for Less or Vaughn's closes and you can't get food? I'm not predicting that's going to happen, but I am looking at things like what the Wall Street Journal is saying and talking about grocery store stockpiling. So my advice is simply this: be prepared. That's the Boy Scout motto. Be prepared. The Mormons have this down to a science. God bless them. They know what it's like to have the food prepared, and Mormon families are taught to be self-sufficient for a year or two with the food that you may need, and that's smart. And hopefully we'll never need it, but what if we do? So be prudent, be prepared. That's my advice. Let's go to John in Northern Michigan. Hi, John.
Hey, I just wanted to make one quick comment on that last call. We call it just-in-time logistics. And that is actually an implementation of the United Nations Agenda 21 that has to do with the amount of food and how it's transported throughout a country and given country, not
Good
a sovereign
point.
Nation, but a country.
Good point.
So I just wanted to let you know that. Now, what I wanted to actually call about was Bill Cosby has recently been released from prison, and immediately upon his release, he flayed the mainstream media by not only one, defending his friend who said she was happy to have a injustice righted by him being released because he is an elderly man in a high level.
Are you talking about Felicia Rashad?
Yes, I am. Okay. He defended her, but he also accused the mainstream media of actually being the insurrectionist and having a part in that, what I would like to call a soft coup, but it was not the acting president who initiated that. He's saying it's the mainstream media. Now, I'm just wondering what your take is, or if you've had any time to digest any of his opinions on things, and how you would feel about someone who's been through that.
Yeah, I have not had enough time to really digest those things. In fact, I'm sure some of it I haven't even heard yet. But my honest opinion, John, is that Bill Cosby needs to sit down and shut up. He doesn't have any credibility to be lecturing anybody about anything, if you ask me. And I'm not interested in what his thoughts are about those matters. I think his credibility is shot. So I'd like to see him go into retirement and be quiet. That's my take on it.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, great. Hey, good talking to you, John. Let's do it again. Until tomorrow, I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. My apologies to all of you who weren't able to get on the air just because of time, but we will do it again tomorrow. Please pray for me. I'll pray for you. God bless you.
Tell one other person about it. It's such a great way to evangelize.
The Relevant Radio app, your Catholic everything app.
Get live radio, podcasts, news, prayers. It's free.
The continuously updated Relevant Radio app. It's in your app store.